Setting up a high voltage or dangerous voltage experiment requires a little bit of forethought if you want to have any margin of safety at all. I presume you read the safety tirade at the beginning of this webpage. Take it seriously. Electricity is to be respected. I focus your attention on the third picture at the beginning, the third drawing. This is a thing called a suicide cord. I didn't give it that name. Other people in the industry did. They're not joking, although it is kind of an industry joke. There is a certain degree of seriousness as for why they call it a suicide cord. In my particular diagram for a suicide cord, I add a little box in the middle. Many of them don't. I think that's real stupid. The box that I show is a switch that, unless you push the button, breaks both sides of the line. This ensures that there's no path on either the positive or the neutral side. The neutral is effectively connected to ground, so you might wonder why I break both circuits. And the reason why is that on a two-prong plug, it's really easy to get the plug in the other way. And if you don't break both sides, you can't guarantee that there won't be any power available. I also show a nail driven right into the table, right into your work table, that is used to anchor the clip leads down to it. The reason for doing this, now you can come up with whatever kind of an attachment you wish. A nail is just a graphic, but it should be a secure way to fasten the cable. In the event that somebody was to walk by and trip over the cord, you don't want a bunch of live wires being dragged by the clip leads into their path. That could be very dangerous. The box itself should be constructed of plastic. Radio Shack has some fairly sturdy, and I recommend getting the sturdiest box you can find. They have some fairly sturdy experimenter boxes that are fairly small. They're inexpensive. They're like, maybe a dollar or two. And they also sell neon glow lamp assemblies with the resistor built in that are good and bright. They tend to be red because the neon glow tubes tend to burn fairly brightly in the red spectrum, and so they put a red lens over them. Red is also a warning color, and you want this thing so that whenever you press the button, the red light comes on to warn you that the clip leads are hot. And you want the button to be constructed in such a way, I didn't show it here in the drawing, but you want the button to be constructed in such a way that it is either recessed or something so that there's no possibility that the box could lean up against something and accidentally push the button. You want pressing this button to be a deliberate act, not something that could accidentally happen. You also want the box to be constructed in such a way that if you were to grip the box as a result of an electric shock, that it wouldn't ensure that the button gets pressed and held. All these things should be considerations. One way that you can do this with most buttons is to drill a hole into a soda bottle cap, like a 2-liter bottle or something, that's the size of the mounting for a button, and turn it upside down so that there's you have to push your finger into a hole in order to press the button at the bottom of this recess. You can invent your own way of doing that. I expect that you're fairly creative, and you'll do something that would prevent the button from accidentally being pushed. Some buttons come with a metal recessed rim around them. I don't suggest that you find a button that is terribly hard to push, because you're going to be holding this button for long periods of time while you're doing testing, and you don't want it to be difficult to, you know, you don't want it to be hard on your fingers to push it. Some of those buttons, the manufacturers of them think that it's a safety feature to make the button difficult to push. The problem with that is that you're inclined to bypass the button or wrap tape around the box or something, which is equally stupid. You want the button to be fairly easy to push. You just don't want it to be accidentally pushed if the box should turn over or slam up against something. When you set up your experiment, the table that you set your experiment on, it's crucial that the top of it be an insulated surface. Now, most tables are made of wood or formica or something, and they tend not to be conductive, but it's easy to overlook the edge of the table. Some people work off of their kitchen table in the absence of any other good work surface. Some kitchen tables have an aluminum trim around the edge that can carry lethal voltage. If you have a table like that, don't use it for high voltage experimenting. That's stupid. Card tables similarly sometimes have a metal trim around them, and sometimes it's painted. It isn't real obvious that it's metal. Metal legs can be dangerous also. The best table, of course, is one that is totally made of wood. Or plastic. There are some fairly sturdy tables made of plastic. I don't advise a plastic table, but if it's good and sturdy, that might be all right. A little bit of setup. Don't just scoot the table close to the wall. That's probably not a real good idea. You know, so that you can get close to the plug outlet, you know, the wall socket. What is probably better is to attach a long, fairly large, you know, heavy-duty anyway, extension cord that's a three-prong grounded plug on the end of it. Not that you want the grounded plug so much for your experiments, but those tend to be cords that have plug where the socket is in line to the end of the cord rather than coming out at 90 degrees like a cheap extension cord tends to be. If you take a long, you know, one of these orange or, you know, bright yellow cords that are meant for yard work or something, and you take the end of it that has the socket, you know, the female, and you tie that to the leg of the table in such a way that it isn't likely that somebody passing by would, you know, tripping over it or something, would carry the plug with them. You also want it in such a way that it's within easy reach. If you can tie it some way to the leg in such a way that it won't slide down and hangs about a foot below the table, then if something were to go dreadfully wrong, you could reach over and grab that cord and yank the plug out of the end of it in a fairly quick way. In the eventuality that the ultimate series of catastrophes would happen, the button would stick or something, and somebody happened to get nailed across the terminals, somebody with a presence of mind could reach over and grab a hold of the plug and yank the cord out and save the day, presumably. So, a little bit about the kind of table and the setup that you want for this. I'm trying to make this experiment with enough thought that if the worst were to go wrong, there's still a way out, if possible. Don't do this alone. It's always best if you've got someone that's sitting there as an onlooker, that in case something were to happen, they would be able to, you know, disconnect the plug. It's not likely that it will, but when you're first starting out, you are more likely to make mistakes without thinking this stuff through, and it wouldn't hurt to have somebody available as an onlooker. Don't let a child that might be curious and therefore inexperienced in the area where this is being carried out. I mean, that should be obvious, but it's amazing how many people will forget things like this. The surface of the table should be clear of anything that's not important to the experiment. Don't have a lot of stuff piled up on the table while you're trying to carry out an experiment like this. You want your work area to be free of things sitting around on it. Obviously, you're going to need tools to work with and things like that. I'm not saying it should be absolutely devoid of anything, but don't have unnecessary things that don't need to be there cluttering up the table, especially if it's bad enough that it crowds your work to one corner or edge of the table. That's just asking for trouble. Okay, I've probably said enough about this. You can follow the diagram and build your suicide cord. The idea of calling it a dead man switch is not my invention either. The purpose of a dead man switch is to cut the power if the person operating it becomes a dead man. That should leave a bit of sobering thought in your mind about what it is that you're dealing with here. The experiment, if it's handled properly, is, I won't say 100% safe. Nothing ever is, but if you follow reasonable safety guidelines and common sense, you can carry out experiments like this with no greater danger than walking in front of a big city bus when the walk light is green. Doing so when it's not green and the bus is in motion is probably not a very wise idea. I'm not here to repeat the stuff that's in the webpage where you presumably were reading it while this thing was loading. Okay, on to bigger and better things. The reason I covered the suicide cord first is because even if you decide to build yourself an isolation transformer, you need to be able to test out the transformers and so forth that you're going to use to build it, and you need some way to power it. Somebody who's new to this stuff could very easily connect up the leads wrong, and although they wouldn't shock themselves, probably, closing the switch would, if the transformer is connected incorrectly, could burn up the transformer. So you don't want to do that. I direct your attention to a couple more frames down. You'll see a thing called a breadboard. Before you actually do any experiments, it's a good idea to set up what people commonly refer to as a breadboard. You get yourself a piece of plastic, or a piece of plywood that's 3/4 or maybe a full inch thick. In other words, a nice thick piece of scrap plywood. You don't have to spend a lot of money on it. And it doesn't even matter what shape it is, if it's an odd shape, as long as it's relatively rectangular or square. You know, I mean, if it's got a funny angle to it, that probably isn't going to cause a problem. You don't want to spend money on this stuff. The plywood, scrap, but it should be, you know, fairly good quality plywood. You don't want, you know, something that's rough on both sides that won't slide nicely on a table. the finished side of the plywood, you probably want to face up. You want to make sure that the plywood isn't soaking wet or something. That would not be a good idea. And furthermore, you want to make sure the plywood doesn't have metal in it. They do make plywood sheeting for the trucking industry, for instance, that has a metal laminate surface on one side. You don't want to use that. You want real plywood that's wood all the way through. You want to find some nails that are real short, like picture hanging nails or something. You can get these kinds of things at a hardware store. Also, while you're at the hardware store, you want to pick up a, if you don't already have one, a small grinder that fits in a hand drill. A little grindstone they probably sell for $3 or $5. And what you do with this thing is you chuck it up in the grinder, or in, you chuck the grindstone into the hand drill, and you take the heads of the nails, and while the thing is spinning, probably with the pliers because they're going to get hot, you rub them up against the spinning stone. The stone doesn't spin very fast, but it doesn't hurt to wear safety glasses. You know, it never hurts to err on the side of caution. But in reality, it doesn't spin very fast. And the likelihood of something like that getting away from you, if you're careful, it won't. If you're stupid, it will. So I'm not going to say don't exercise caution. I'm just saying don't be afraid of it. You want to grind the heads of the nails just enough to kind of knock off the metal to where there's nice shiny metal underneath, because nails are seldom very clean. And when you get down to bare metal, then get out your soldering iron and heat the nail up enough that solder will flow smoothly onto the head of the nail. You don't want to put a lot of buildup on it, just enough that the solder liquefies and you know, flows out over the top of the nail head. You prepare a quantity of nails, maybe 10 or 15 nails this way, and you drive them into the board in such a way that they don't stick out on the other side, and that you're certain that they don't stick out on the other side, because the idea is to use the board itself, the piece of plywood, as an insulator, but yet a firm mounting of things. You drive them in, and you can solder components down directly to, as I've shown in this figure, you can solder components directly to the heads of the nails. If they're already pre-treated and you've coated them with solder, the solder will take very easily. It just, you know, you heat the component lead up and it'll solder right to it, no problem. The other thing about driving them into plywood, if you're going to solder them like this, is that plywood, being an electrical insulator, is also a thermal insulator. This is a pretty common trait among most electrical insulators. There are a few that are specially designed to avoid that, ceramics and so on. But being a thermal insulator, it won't soak up the heat from the nail. If you tried to solder the nail with it chucked into something like a big heavy vise, the vise would draw away all the heat that you're trying to solder it with. So if you find yourself having trouble tinning the head, that's the process where right after you ground it to where you get shiny metal, you put a little bit of solder on it. If you have trouble doing that, say you've got the nail chucked into a pair of vise grips or something, one way around that problem is to wrap a little bit of paper around the nail and then chuck that into the vise grips. The paper will act as a thermal insulator, and it'll allow the nail to get hot without the heat leaking out into the vise grips. That will give you a way to adequately treat the heads of the nails if you can't figure out some other way. At any rate, you get these nails driven in at intervals that the components will solder to, and you anchor them down. plywood is also real good about screws. You can get screws from the hardware store if you don't already have them sitting around the house somewhere. The screws, you want to get a light socket from the hardware store while you're there. Just a regular, you know, mount it down to a piece of plywood kind of light socket. Nothing fancy. You want a couple of terminals that you can hook up to with a light socket fairly well fastened down to the plywood. Now, why a light socket? Well, light bulbs are very interesting devices electrically. Until they actually light up, their cold resistance is very low, on the order of maybe a few tens of ohms. When they get hot, however, they go up a factor of 10 or 100 in resistance. Resistance changes radically in the filament when the filament gets hot. So a light bulb can serve as a kind of non-destructive fuse. If you screw in a 150-watt light bulb into this socket and you take your suicide cord and clip one clip lead to one of the terminals of the light socket, and then the other terminal, you go through whatever circuit is that you're gonna experiment with back to the other clip lead, and you press the switch. If you goofed up somehow, and you ended up with a short circuit, the light bulb will simply light up. That saves things from going sparky and kicking the circuit breaker back in the kitchen or on the outdoor panel or in the garage or wherever it is that your circuit breaker panel is. And it also saves things from exploding, like maybe your meter that you just paid good money for. It might still do damage to it, but it's less likely that it'll do real serious damage to it. It may still be serviceable after such an event, depending on what range you had it on. The other thing a light bulb is good for, you know, aside of saving you from direct shorts or insufficient resistance, another thing a light bulb is good for doing is testing big heavy transformers. If you get the primary, say you use about a 60-watt or 100-watt light bulb, if you get the primary of a power transformers that are 300 watts, even. I mean, that sounds like a lot of wattage for a little, you know, in series with a little 60 or 100-watt light bulb. But, in fact, a 300-watt transformer, you know, VA transformer, volts times amps, which takes into consideration phase angle. That's why they refer to it as VA, but for our purposes, I'll just call it watts. A transformer that size, without any secondary load, in other words, you don't have the secondary connected to anything, it's just open-circuited, actually doesn't draw very much, and a 60 or 100-watt bulb in series with a transformer like that will kind of glow dim. It'll, if you measure it, there'll only be about 30 volts across it. Most of the voltage will be across the transformer. Now, if you had the primary of a transformer connected up in series with a light bulb and hooked up to your suicide cord, you press the button, it kind of glows dim. If, while it were glowing dim, the secondary were to be shorted out, the bulb would suddenly glow brightly. That's because the transformer impedance drops considerably if you short its secondary. And doing this will demonstrate the notion that a transformer, even though the windings are not in any way, shape, or form electrically connected, the primary creates a magnetic field, and the magnetic field couples into the secondary, and whenever that secondary starts drawing current, it is felt on the primary side. And so the bulb becomes an indicator that shows you the amount of current, kind of indirectly through how bright it is. It becomes an indicator that will demonstrate, or at least give you some indication that you're drawing more or less current than you were before. When you're trying to make test measurements to make sure that you've got things hooked up right, it never hurts to put a lamp, you know, a 100-watt lamp or something, in series with the thing that you're trying to test. If you accidentally got the secondary, the low-voltage secondary of a transformer connected up, the bulb would light up real bright. And that would tell you you got something wrong. And you might puzzle over it a little bit and go, ooh, I didn't mean to do that. And you connect the leads on the proper side, and then it glows dim whenever you push the button. If you hadn't been using the lamp and you connected the secondary, a low-voltage secondary, to the power, that's not good. The transformer will buzz real loud and it'll tend to hiss at you. The hissing sound that it makes is as a result of the waxy substance inside the transformer boiling rapidly, and it, you know, it kind of steams out. And if you ever do that to a transformer, it no longer will reliably insulate the way it once did. It's not good for a transformer to do that to it. And in fact, if you do it for more than just a few seconds, it'll destroy it. Burn the windings open. So, this was just a mild introduction to a larger issue that I'll get into whenever I get into the actual experiment itself. You need to go out and acquire some of these materials and build up some of this stuff so that you got it on hand. Another thing is, how do you connect all these nail heads together? Well, you want to stop by Radio Shack or some surplus electronics place or whatever and get yourself several packages of these little gator clip things they make. They make these little leads, you know, it's just a piece of wire, insulated, of course, with two little gator clippies on each end that have little, you know, soft plastic booties on them so that you don't have to touch the metal to connect and disconnect the clip lead. I wouldn't try and hook the clip leads up to, you know, dangerous voltages, even though they have booties on them. The suicide cord breaks the circuit as soon as you let go of the switch, but I wouldn't rely on that either. When you're going to, especially when you're first starting out and you're unsure of these kinds of issues, you haven't worked with this stuff before, it's a darn good idea to unplug that suicide cord from the extension cord that I suggested that you tie around the table leg. That way there's a visual signal there that says this is now safe to touch. With that thing plugged in, all that has to happen is somebody push the button, and if you're hanging on to live wires, you get nailed, potentially fatally. So as an added safety precaution, I would urge you to unplug the thing before you go handling things. After a while, you'll kind of get a feel for what is low voltage and what is high voltage. You use your own judgment there at some point. But certainly when you're first starting out, unplug the apparatus before you touch anything in it. Okay, well, on to the next segment.